Philly himself got Oofy's Uncle Horace. He'd not been aware till then that Oofy had an Uncle Horace, and at the conclusion of the drawing he went over to where the plutocrat was sitting reading the morning's mail to make inquiries. "Who is this uncle of yours I've drawn, Oofy?" he asked. "I didn't know you had an uncle."
"Nor did I," said Oofy, "till I got a letter from him the other day signed Uncle Horace. It's rather odd. I could have sworn that my only uncles were Hildebrand, who had an apoplectic stroke in 1947, and Stanley, who died of cirrhosis of the liver in 1949. But apparently this is one I overlooked, no doubt because he's been in the Argentine for the last 20 years. He returned to England last week, and is staying at a place called Holrock Manor in Hertfordshire. I haven't seen him yet, but he'll be lunching with me here on the big day."
"I wonder if he's fat."
"I shouldn't think so. Warm climate, the Argentine. Keeps the weight down. And isn't that the place where you spend your whole time riding over pampas?" "No, I wouldn't build any hopes, Freddy. Not a chance of him nosing out your Uncle Rodney. But excuse me, old man. I must be catching up with my reading."
Freddy drifted away disconsolately, and Oofy returned to his letters. One of these bore the address of Holrock Manor. He read it without any great interest, but was mildly intrigued by the postscript. "P.S.," his uncle wrote, "you must be wondering what I look like these days, not having seen me since you were a child. I enclose a snapshot taken in the garden the other morning." Oofy examined the envelope, but could find no snapshot. Then, looking down, he saw that it had fallen to the floor. He picked it up, and the next moment had sagged back in his chair with a stifled cry. It was the photograph of an elderly man in a bathing suit. An elderly man who, a glance was enough to tell, had been overdoing it on the starchy foods since early childhood. An elderly man so rotund, so obese, so bulging in every direction that Shakespeare, had he beheld him, would have muttered to himself, "Upon what meat does this our Horace feed that he has grown so great?" One wondered how any bathing suit built by human hands could contain so stupendous an amount of uncle without parting at the seams. In the letter he had written to Oofy, announcing his arrival in England, Horace Prosser had spoken of coming home to lay his bones in the old country. There was nothing in the snapshot to suggest that he had any bones. Little wonder, then, that as he ran his eye over the man reading from left to right, Oofy should have been feeling the same sort of stunned, breathless feeling he would have felt had this uncle fallen on him from the top of a high building. With pitiless clarity it was borne in on him that the blister ticket over which he'd been gloating was not worth the paper it was written on. Compared with this mastodon, Lord Blister was slim to the point of emaciation and hadn't a hope. And the thought that Freddy Widgeon, and not he, would win all that lovely money was like a dagger in Oofy's bosom. We said earlier that he did not need the cash, but it was we who said it, not Oofy. His views on the matter were sharply divergent. Whenever there was cash around, he wanted to get it. It was well said of him at the Drones that despite his revolting wealth, he would always willingly walk 10 miles in tight boots to pick up tuppence. Many put the figure even lower. How long he sat there motionless he could not have said, but after a while his subtle and scheming brain, temporarily numbed, began to function again, and he perceived that all was not yet lost. There was, he saw, a way of achieving the happy ending. It called for the cooperation of a party of the second part of an innocent and unsuspicious nature, and no one could have filled the bill more adequately than Frederick Widgeon, a man whose trust in his fellow men was a byword. Frederick Widgeon, he knew for a fact, believed everything he read in Time. He sought him out and laid a gentle hand on his sleeve.
"Freddy, old man," he said, "can you spare me a moment of your valuable time?" Freddy said he could. "I don't know," said Oofy, "if you were glancing in my direction just now."
Freddy said he wasn't.
"Well, if you had been, you'd have noticed that I was plunged in meditation, and I'll tell you why. Have you ever been a Boy Scout?"
Freddy said he hadn't.
"I was one at one time, and I've never forgotten the lessons I learnt in those knickerbocker and spooring days."
"Tie knots, do you mean, and lighting fires by rubbing sticks together?"
"Not so much that as the doing one's daily good deed routine. Boy Scouts, as you probably know, are supposed to perform at least one act of kindness every 24 hours, and a very good thing, too. Keeps them up on their toes.
Yes, I can see that. It would, of course.
Now, one rather tends, as one grows older, to give the daily good deed a miss. And it's all wrong. One shouldn't. There's no reason whatever why, just because one no longer goes about in a khaki shirt with a whistle attached to it, one should omit those little acts of kindness which sweeten life for all and sundry. One ought to keep plugging away. This came to me very forcibly just now, as I sat thinking about this sweepstake thing we're having. Is it right? Is it fair? I asked myself, that I, to whom money means nothing, should have drawn the favourite, while somebody who really needs the stuff, like my old friend Freddie Widgeon, gets stuck with a rank outsider. There could be but one answer. It was not right. It was not fair. It was something that had to be adjusted.
How do you mean adjusted?
Quite simple. We must swap tickets. I taking my uncle's, and you yours. Yes, yes, said Ufi, seeing that his old friend was gaping at him like a bewildered codfish. You're naturally surprised. It seems to you bizarre that I should be doing myself out of 100 quid or whatever it is. But what you overlook is that I shall be getting the glow that comes from feeling that one's done an act of kindness and helped a fellow human being on the road to happiness. What is 100 quid compared with that?
But
don't say but, Freddy. I insist on this. No. Don't thank me. My motives are purely selfish. I want to glow.
And Ufi went off to tell the Crumpet to record the change of tickets in the official notebook in which the names of the ticket holders were listed. He was glowing. It's a very incurious and phlegmatic nephew who, when he has an uncle whose adiposity is going to net him more than £100, does not hasten to go and take a look at that uncle, if only to assure himself that the latter is wading into the mashed potatoes in a satisfactory manner and getting his full supply of bread, butter, beer, roly-poly pudding and pastries. On the following morning, preceded by a telegram saying that he was coming to lunch, Ufi started out in his car for Holrock Manor. He pictured a fine old house with spacious grounds, and found on arrival that his imagination had not led him astray. Holrock Manor was plainly a place where the money did themselves well, and always of a greedy nature. He found his mouth watering at the prospect of the lavish luncheon of which he would shortly be partaking. His drive had given him a rare appetite. He inquired for Mr. Horace Prosser, and presently the other came wheezing along, and after a certain amount of well-well-welling, and so here you are at lasting, inevitable in the circumstances, they went into the dining-room and seated themselves at a table. It gratified Ufi to note that as his relative lowered himself into his chair, the chair visibly quivered beneath him and gave out a protesting squeal. On his journey down, he had from time to time an uneasy feeling that that snapshot might have exaggerated the other's proportions, but one glance had been enough to tell him that these were idle fears. Now that he saw the man in the flesh, he felt, like the Queen of Sheba, that the half had not been told unto him. The only thing that disturbed him was that, no doubt in a moment of absent-mindedness, his host had not suggested the pre-luncheon martini, in anticipation of which he'd been licking his lips for the last hour. And as the waiter presented the bill of fare, it seemed to occur to Mr. Prosser that he'd been remiss. He hastened to explain his eccentric behaviour.
"Sorry I couldn't offer you a cocktail, my boy. We don't have them here. But they serve an excellent glass of parsnip juice if you care for it. No? Then suppose we order. Will you have stewed lettuce, or do you prefer an orange? Ah, but wait. I see we're in luck. This is grated carrot day. How about starting with potassium broth, going on to grated carrots, and winding up with a refreshing cup of dandelion coffee?"
At an early point in these remarks, Ufi's lower jaw had drooped like a tired lily. He hitched it up in order to ask a question.
"I say, what is this place?"
"It used to belong to Lord Somebody, or Sir Somebody Something, I forget which. Like so many landowners, he had to sell after the war. Impossible to keep the old home up. Sad, very sad."
"Sadder than potassium broth?"
"Don't you like potassium broth? You could have seaweed soup if you wish."
"But I don't understand. Is this a hotel?"
"Well, more a clinic, I suppose you'd call it. We come here to reduce."
It's not easy to totter when seated in a chair.